Welcome to Independent Curriculum, the podcast. Independent Curriculum highlights the ideas, organizations, schools, and individuals playing important roles in shaping the future of education. I'm Peter Gao, Executive Director of the Independent Curriculum Group, a global consortium of over 140 schools interested in building stronger, more effective academic programs that meet the needs of their own students in alignment with each school's unique mission and values. You can learn more about us by visiting our website at independentcurriculum.org. In this episode of Independent Curriculum, the podcast, we continue our interview with Tim Fish, Chief Innovation Officer at the National Association of Independent Schools. Tim has long been an important voice in some of the most impactful conversations about the future of education, and we are grateful for his willingness to be with us. I am personally delighted to continue the conversation begun in part one. Another point you touched on, actually, when you were talking about your own sort of journey was the move from the public school system to McDonough, and that you saw McDonough as a greenhouse, as kind of a place to try new things, as a testbed for new ideas. And I have been probably loud and obnoxious in various quarters on believing that independent schools have that not just as an opportunity, but as something of an obligation. We're given all kinds of regulatory freedoms, and I believe that the idea of that freedom is that in return we become some kind of independent schools, rather, become a kind of social good. And I think that test bed is the place where that social good can be expressed. And I'm just sort of wondering, you know, whether you have further thoughts on that notion, or whether you see things, or NAIS sees things, or how NAIS, if it does see things that way, can support that test bed concept.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think that the thing that makes independent schools so great is our ability to innovate and to think about new ideas and new concepts. I think that's a lot of the position that sort of this role that I'm have the opportunity to be in right now is about helping schools to do that work, to think about creative ways to try new things. I think that one of the things that's sometimes challenging for schools is, and I know that I experienced this not only a little bit at McDonough, but also in all the schools where I had the opportunity to help them out in various ways. Is it's just really hard sometimes to find the time and the energy and to take the risk to try something new. It's not sort of how we're wired, right? And what I find in schools is that I think we're really good at solving like what I call above the line problems, right? We're really good at like figuring out how to make the line in the cafeteria move more flow better, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's a backup in the line and we got to figure that out. We got to move the soup bar to over here. Like we're really, really good at that stuff. What we're not really good at, I think often, is the 5 to 10 year strategic challenges that are facing a lot of our schools.
You said that we're not always very good at structuring those 5 year plans. And I think probably one of the reasons so many people are cynical about that whole process are the failed plans we have from the past that are, you know, maybe not even failed plans, but they are plans that weren't well defined or well made to begin with. And in many cases, there wasn't a great expectation that they would all come true or that they would, you know, serve their intended purpose in the end. You have been around and seen a lot of schools in the last few years. through your work with Folio and just because you're somebody that people want to talk to and show their schools to. What are right now the big questions that you see schools grappling with? And are there sort of commonalities in these big questions? Are there, you know, three or four giant questions? And maybe I'll even stipulate that enrollment and tuition are so clearly at the top of that list, we probably don't even need to talk about those. I guess I'm thinking really in terms of programmatic ways forward that schools are finding challenging.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that, you know, in my mind, I would have put the first bit, enrollment and tuition and sort of that piece, under sort of, you know, living our mission in a sustainable way, right? In that, you know, as I think the economics are changing in some ways, not everywhere, but certainly in some parts of the country and some types of schools. So I think many schools are really having to acknowledge that challenge and sort of see their way through it. And I think that is top of mind for many schools. I think some of the other challenges, though, that are facing schools, one for me that I've spent some time thinking a lot about over the last few years is equity, diversity, and inclusion. And I say that because I know that personally I've come a long way in my thinking about this topic, and I would not even begin to suggest that you ever achieve sort of the all you need to know about this, or that I think it is absolutely a lifelong journey. But what I've sort of come to is the idea that work, that building that capacity to be thinking about equity and diversity throughout what we do in our schools has to be deliberate, right, and ongoing. And I think what's hard sometimes in our schools is that we may have the tendency to sort of like, okay, we talked about that at Professional Day last February, so we're good with that now. Let's move on, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that for me, that the more you do that work, the more you see you need to do that work, right? Like it's this amazing process where you start getting into it and you find you just need to get into it more, and you start getting, and you're just like, we got to get into this more. And it's amazing, but it's such important work for students and for communities to do. So for me, that's one that over the last 4 years has been a real aha for me about how deliberate and focused that needs to be. Another one, I think that if you were to sort of think about sometimes what schools are grappling with, is the idea of sort of at the heart of it, like, what are we really about? What do we really do, right? It's kind of a mission question. But it's you know, I think that that when we think about learning and teaching, and we think about what our day looks like, and we think about priorities, and we look at resources, I think a really honest conversation about what that is, what we really do as a school, and what is differentiated, what's at the heart of who we want to be and who we are, and who do we serve, and how do we serve that community, I think is a conversation that a lot of schools are having, and many schools maybe need to have. Because I think that gives way to a lot of the other kinds of work, right? And it's sort of saying, this is what we want to be about. This is the kind of place we want to be. And we're going to be real deliberate about doing the work that we need to do that. And I also think that, I think one of the other things for me with schools is evolving leadership, right? I just think that the roles are changing in some ways. I think if you look at the changing nature of what a head of school is and needs to be and will need to be, right? There's an evolution of that role. How you build a really high functioning team, not only a leadership team, administrative team, but a really high-functioning faculty group and a really high-functioning English department. One of my favorite schools is University Child Development School in Seattle. And I think UCDS has built some of the best, what I call interdependent teams that I've ever seen, right? Where I can't do my job without Peter also, you know, doing it. Like, you and I are totally tied to each other, right? And they, when I met with Paula Smith, their head of school, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but I met with her when I was doing the folio year, and I said, Paula, like, what's at the heart of UCDS, right? And her answer was something like this. It was, probably wasn't exactly this. It was something like, we don't believe in the superstar teacher, right? And that, I was like, what? Like, that's what we do in independent schools as superstar teachers. Like, what do you mean by that? And it was this whole notion that we don't want the autonomous superstar who teaches fourth grade for 40 years and defines what is fourth grade. We would much rather have an incredibly talented team player who does 3 years in fourth grade and 2 years in kindergarten and 4 years in fifth grade and 3 years back in second grade. And like, they're like, that's who we want, right? And I thought, boy, being deliberate and focused by that is an incredible thing. And I don't know that, you know, I think one of our challenges is I don't know that we have that team capacity in schools today. And we do in pockets, and we certainly have it. Many schools are doing it well. But as I look out, again, I've become really interested in the idea around the capacity to do great work moving forward. And what, that's part leadership, that's part team, that's part mission, right? And it's, and for me, those are different than saying it's an admissions challenge or a marketing challenge or a financial model challenge or we have to cut expenses. Those all may be consequences of some of the things that come out of having those other pieces really strongly in place. But I think having those pieces strongly in place give a school the capacity to get through any of that stuff over time. In my mind, I don't know what you. What do you think of that? I mean, that's kind of what my gut says.
I think you're right. I think there's another piece, though, which has to do with not just capacity but confidence. I like the idea that schools have the capacity, but then I often see schools that I think are probably ready to do something new and different, but they're not sure that they can, and that confidence is usually market-based. Sometimes the anxieties are based in a, and I'll use the word fear, of upsetting a faculty that has perhaps been given a great deal of autonomy over the years, where the superstar is the model, and where change is terrifying. But I think about schools, and I'm sort of wondering what you think about this in return, as in many cases, schools can do way more than they think they can. And I think that they can, in just in terms of the market issue, I think they can leverage their own brands within their own community and within the community of prospective families to do much more interesting things than they are willing to do. I often hear from schools that are, you know, the independent curriculum group has this heritage in the discussions around the value of advanced placement designated courses. It's an old conversation and not one that I'm super excited to be a part of. But when I get those questions, I'm often hearing them from schools that probably could go ahead and do anything they wanted, but they are afraid to leverage their own, you know, they talk about themselves as and are regarded in their communities as excellent schools, excellent places to get an education, excellent faculties, and yet there's that fear that if we do something different, that everything will change, and I think that confidence that goes along with capacity. Capacity is obviously sort of an essential precondition. But once they have the capacity, and I think a lot of schools have lots of capacity, to use that capacity, to apply it fully in the face of whatever their anxieties might be that are more material, maybe, and more instrumental than really focused on kids, because in theory, what we're doing is providing the best education that we can possibly give and the best experiences that we can possibly give. And I'm not just talking about independent schools, but all schools, to our students. So let's figure out how to do that. And then let's have the courage, not just the courage to teach in Parker Palmer's construction, but the courage to change how we teach. And I think that would be an exciting change going forward. And one, I think many schools are wrestling with this. They're on the verge. I think some schools are doing it. Some schools are doing it in small pieces. Lots of schools are talking about it. I would imagine there are a fair number of schools that are you know, pushing their heads more deeply into the sand to avoid talking about it. But I think those are schools about whose future I might have some anxiety myself.
I think you're right about, I love your idea of the confidence. Because I think you're right. Having that capacity by itself as a sort of isolated skill set, is not enough, right? You need to have the confidence to try something. And I think that there is, each school is different. I think they're facing sort of a different market and a different parent perceptions and different traditions and different history and all that. But I think we often think that we can't do more. I'm a big believer that with a compelling story and a clear vision that's based in what truly is what we believe is great for kids, I think people give a lot of latitude to schools to do that work well. I think there's a lot of families entrust our schools to be the experts in this area. And I do think they expect us to be able to speak about it with clarity about what we believe and what we're trying to do. But I think when we do that, I think they're like, okay, let's go try it. You know, let's go do it. So I think storytelling is key to success in the confidence area, right? That you sort of become a good storyteller about what it is you're about and what you do. And so I think that takes some time to be thinking about. But I think if you have that, and that's not just from the head of school. For me, it's sort of the community has a shared belief. That's what I love so much about schools like UCDS, right? The vision about what they do. I mean, Paula is the keeper of that flame in some ways, possibly as the head of school, but that doesn't come from her only. I mean, that is deeply in the fabric of the place, in its DNA, if you will. And I think that's really important, is to get that belief and that common shared idea. And the better you have that, I think the better you're able to try new things and take some things on. And I also think there's something about schools that have gone through sort of tough times, right? They've often said we've gone up to that edge and we kind of got through it and we're still around, right? And it gives them this newfound confidence that, you know what, you know, we're not going to go under, you know, it's not going to end. We can do some things. So I think that your point about confidence is a really good one.
And the other thing that goes with that, the schools that have been and sort of viewed the abyss and,
right,
and managed to not go there, I think that they need to, you know, leverage that confidence internally, that you can ask people to do things in new ways, or ask people to do sometimes more things, or ask people to work in a more collaborative way, and that's okay. And schools that have been there, I think, are the schools and the ones that have been there and are now thriving. Those are the schools that can do the innovative work, that can set aside the worries about, you know, autonomy or you know, when everybody realizes they have to pull together, and if every, and when everybody realizes that pulling together makes the school better, makes the experience better for students, and makes the experience better for the adults in the community, then surprise, surprise, new ideas aren't met with horror and skepticism, but they're embraced by everyone, and things move forward quickly. I want to get to sort of a last question, and I think in some ways the what we've just been talking about kind of has alluded to some of this, but I think about this, and I'm sure you do, and I suspect your colleagues at NAIS do, but independent schools are, I think, subject, especially in the current economy, perhaps, to some warp factors, I call them, that are potentially kind of dangerous. One is the extreme pressure around college placement and college admission, and the way I think many schools and certainly many parents, way that can affect the way people think about curriculum, the way people think about, you know, simple things like grading, things like standardized testing. And so there's that factor. And I think the other factor that is worrisome because it relates to everything you were saying earlier about diversity and inclusion is the income gap issue in American life and the wealth gap issue. And how schools are going to be able to save themselves from becoming, once again, as many of them once were, 125, 150 years ago, kind of tools of the 1%, or serving only the 1%, or the 1/10 of 1%. Mm-hmm. How do schools need saving from themselves, do you think?
I don't know that they need saving from themselves. I think that if I were a head of school, right, one of the things I would hope that I would have in a board member would be, or in board members would be, folks who are asking me questions like that question. Mm-hmm. Because I think, you know, I think they need to be, I think we all in this business, in this industry, need to be conscious of what you talked about. And we need to be thinking about, we need to be asking ourselves those questions. Because I do think that that it would be very easy if you didn't have provocative people like you asking those questions for us to become, you know, servants of the 1%, right? You know, sort of changing what we do and how we do it in order to attract and maintain full pay families, right? Because that's how you keep the economic engine running, and that's how you sort of get things done. And I don't think that, I mean, I think schools, you know, need to have revenue, and most of that revenue does come from tuition. So I don't think you cannot think about that. But I think you always want to be asking about how are our schools accessible to a much broader spectrum of kids? And what exactly are we doing within our mission to ensure that we're meeting that goal? You know, so one example would be, you know, Bernie Ngo at Lakeside is starting a micro school, right? I don't know if you've heard about this, but
I have not.
So Lakeside is creating, you know, the idea is to create sort of a school in the city that's a much, much smaller version, like some of the micro schools that are starting up around the country. You know, it's 50 kids. It's much, much lower tuition. It doesn't have everything that Lakeside in Seattle has, but it has a great education with great teachers and so much of what Lakeside has always done. But also providing that at a much lower cost, right? And also hits in a geographic area for families for whom Lakeside might have been too far away, right? So to spread the mission of the school, right? I think I don't want to speak certainly for Lakeside or for Bernie here, but I think part of that is how do we expand this work that we've done to serve more kids, right? and think about that, right? So I think that that's the kind, these are the kind of conversations that should be happening in board meetings and should be happening with boards and heads and thinking about these things, because I do think that there are some, as you call them, warp points?
Warp factors.
Warp factors, right? These things that are like these real accelerators or pressures that are facing our schools. I think that that's definitely true. And so it's how do we get through those and think about those with each of our schools individually? I think it's a great point. And one that I just hope the conversations are taking place. I hope the folks are thinking through and being willing to sort of reach in. And, you know, one of the things I love from Jim Collins' work is sort of the whole notion of confront the brutal facts, right? And ask the really hard questions and stay true to your core. So I think those are all, I think it's a great point that you make, and it's one that we're all going to have to really keep thinking about.
You make me think a little bit as I am hearing that of some experience that I've had in my own, I guess, family educational history around the sharing of good practice. And I, at some point, and I think I was probably a little misguided and over-optimistic in my initial revelation, which was that, especially during the No Child Left Behind era, sort of starting in the late 1990s, when there's been enormous technological change, when there's been enormous development in our understanding of how learning happens, of just the brain function involving learning, that independent schools, which were not subject, except I guess in Ohio or wherever, to state standardized testing regimes, mm-hmm. have had this freedom to develop curriculum and to develop ideas around pedagogy and teaching and learning that many public school systems, and, you know, maybe not the most affluent and the most sort of successful by conventional measures, but many public school systems were totally sort of bound over to the work of preparing kids for whatever the state testing was under No Child Left Behind. And it hasn't entirely gone away. The Common Core has kind of crept in to take some of that place. But here are our schools where we have been free to do anything we want to teach with technology in 1,000 different ways, to approach the whole idea of how we organize curriculum in many different ways, to talk about student-centered learning, to send students out on project-based work. And it occurred to me one day that we had all this experience, and there was no way for the independent school community to collect and then transmit that information. I think there is a great deal that public school systems have and public school teachers and educators have to teach independent school people. I'm not talking about it's not a one-sided relationship, but independent schools are pretty good about taking care of their own business, but have not been a part of the conversation. They have not been a part of the conversation around teaching and learning on a national level to the degree that we might. Is that an area where NAIS is thinking about? And again, it's earlier in your experience there, but is that an area that NAIS is thinking about, or that do you think we should be thinking about school should be thinking about?
I think absolutely. I mean, and there's what's so fascinating that I've seen since I've been there at NAIS has been how much, you know, how many great organizations are having this conversation now that we can sort of partner with and listen to and work with, right? And so I think that's one of the things that's really great. I also think, though, that as NAIS is thinking with schools about what does the future of education look like, what does the future of great schools look like, what are the characteristics of great schools, you can't engage in that conversation without also engaging in some way in what does great teaching look like. But at the same time, I think NAIS has always been very cautious to honor the autonomy of every school, right? So it's been this, it's sort of like, this is not how to teach, but here's some examples of what other folks are doing. Here's some examples of things that are working. And I think NAIS has done things like the Inspiration Lab and often in issues of Independent School Magazine and lots of different things going on at the annual conference, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that there's this, you know, innovation task force that Kwai Lei is running. And, you know, there's a bunch of different things that are going on. But I think that always engaging in thoughtful conversation about teaching will be important as schools are thinking about where they're headed and what they're doing and the work they're doing. I just have been so impressed, both when I was working at McDonough and when I was doing some stuff with Folio and now doing some things with NAIS, how much activity there is within our schools around this topic, right? I think there's a lot of really good thinking and energy in schools and people in schools that are activated on this topic and are thinking about it, and teachers who are trying new things. Sometimes it may not be as like focused and as maybe as systemic within a school, but there are these pockets, if you will, of really interesting stuff going on, I think, in pretty much every one of our schools. And I'd love to try to find a way to sort of give voice to all that, and to share it and get people to be able to connect. How exactly that happens yet, it's too early for me to know. But I think if you're in the education business today, that you're in a conversation about teaching, I think it's very difficult to not be. And so I'm excited about continuing to connect Peter with ICG and with other organizations like it that are doing great work in this area.
Well, thank you. I'm looking forward to being in more conversations with you and with your colleagues at NAIS around these very questions, because I think the future of education depends on everybody who's got good ideas finding ways to share those ideas, and everyone who has great questions, and I think all of us have great questions, we need to have more and better forums for sharing those questions and poking around and trying to figure out what is the best way, or, you know, what are the best ways, because there's seldom one best way. What are the best ways to do some of the things we're trying to do? And, in fact, are we trying to do the things that are best for kids and best for the future of the planet? So it's an incredible task we all have ahead of us, but it should be a lot of fun. And I wish you all the fun in the world doing the work you're doing at NAIS. I think I envy you the size of the organization and the sheer number of schools that you can learn more about and that are going to be eager to hear what you have to say and how you can help them and how you can make those connections between one school and another and one idea and another, because it's great work. And I wish you all the best.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you for always answering the phone when I call. You know, you and I have talked many times over the years, and I have always enjoyed our conversations. I look forward to many more conversations as we move forward.
Well, as do I, and so I will extend my official thanks and thanks to our listeners for having been a part of this as we go forward with the new ICG podcast project. So thank you, Tim, and all good wishes for your work in the future.
Thanks, Peter.
This ends Independent Curriculum's interview with Tim Fish, Chief Innovation Officer at the National Association of Independent Schools. This is Peter Gao, thanking you for listening today and looking forward to having you with us for more episodes of Independent Curriculum, the podcast.